we need to wake up to and learn the ways of the world before you lose your freedom to even do so. Let's assume that you want to rob a bank. What do you think the best way to go about it would be? Do you think you should just storm into the bank with no plan and just kind of make it up as you go, see what happens, maybe hope that you don't walk across the wrong section of hallway so that you don't get seen on a security camera? Maybe you take out a couple people, you don't know what to bring, you're just going to improvise scare tactics and weapons on the fly? Is that the best way to do it? Or would you have to plan it meticulously ahead of time? Would you have to make sure that you knew how the bank operated? Would you have to make sure that you knew who was on shift? What the personality characteristics and traits of the people that were working there? What they are? How they scare? All sorts of stuff that you'd want to know intimately about that particular bank, the particular time that you're planning to rob the bank, the response time that the cops have. You want to know the whole shebang, so you need to plan ahead of time. There should be no further convincing necessary in order to recognize that that is the truth. Now, when you are in control of nations and populations, and you want to see a certain agenda unfold in that target demographic, in that target nation, what you have to do is you have to incite social change by manipulating key variables in the environment, in the population, in the people, and manipulate these variables so that the changes that you want to see come about actually do come about. And in order for that to happen, it requires planning. Having a solid understanding of psychology and learning what makes people do what motivates people to do what, is very important for you as a social engineer to understand, because it is only in understanding what humans respond to you can create an engineer circumstance so as to trigger that response and make the human mind more amenable, more malleable, or more likely to go along with what it is that you said you wanted to do.
Because we had had a fire alarm earlier that day, and that was a drill, so we thought this was a drill too, just another one. Because we have a lot of fire alarms, a lot of fire drills at the school. After we heard the first gunshot, we initially thought it was a drill. Actually, that was a bad choice.
It's okay, you're fine.
Actually, that was a bad choice because the janitor... Sorry.
It's okay, you're fine, David, you're fine.
Honestly, when I was going out, I was kind of in... I was in... Hold on.
It's okay.
When I was going out, I was in shock.
Just saying, I don't know how to put this in perspective. It's okay.
So most of my friends that made it out, one of them went into a bathroom in the same... I believe in the same hallway as the shooter. Well, hold on. One of them went into the same bathroom, I believe, as the hallway shooter. He was in there at the same time, and he was in the bathroom, and he didn't know if he was going to live.
The concept of false flag terrorism has become more and more set in the public mind. Thankfully. Happily. There's lots of literature on this now. People are starting to wake up to the ways and the tools of manipulation. The tools of social control. And there is a formulaic way to look at false flag terror. False flag terror essentially meaning if you want a certain outcome, then what you do is you actually force the problem. You actually create the problem that necessitates your particular solution. So rather than see it unfold naturally as a byproduct of just some sort of occurrence, you actually take initiative and you cause the problem so that the particular problem leads to the result that you wanted in the first place. Most of the widespread, mass publicly disseminated events of either fear or terror or anything that causes immense social change, you are almost guaranteed to be looking at some sort of top-down controlled exercise to scare or terrorize or galvanize the public into a way, into a modality of thinking that is expedient for the policymakers, for the social engineers. And when you're dealing with false flag campaigns, there's a set formula that has been tried, tested, and true, and has been used throughout human history. And one of the elements of this formula that you can use to determine and pick out whether something was a false flag or not, or whether something was planned ahead of time, is the use of drills. Meaning, what these insane psychopaths do, what they do is they plan a drill to occur in close proximity time-wise to the actual event as it's taking place, as it's scheduled to take place. The classic example would be 9/11. On 9/11, there were actual intelligence agency drills and war simulations of a response to planes flying into buildings on the very same day, okay? Now, besides the obvious headache that you would incur in trying to imagine what the statistical odds are of a military drill going on at the exact same time that just conveniently, coincidentally, the actual real life thing is happening at the same time. I mean, the odds are ineffable, to say the least. I don't even have words to describe how unlikely that is. So ignoring that, what having a drill taking place at the same time of the terrorist event or the false flag event does, what the advantage that that provides is that because of the nature of the drill, law enforcement agencies and powers are diverted away from that particular scenario because it's known that there is a drill going on. So you get this attenuating of police or military forces to deal with that thing because it's a drill. And obviously, there's no terrorist attack that's going to be happening during the drill. So it's a way to shunt forces away from the area so that you can do what you want to do. What it also does is it also conceals the intention of the people responsible for implementing the false flag attack. If their papers, if their planning documents were ever to get leaked, then they could just say, oh, well, these weren't actual plans for a false flag terror event. These were just training scenarios in case it happened. So they can literally just say, no, it's not a plan, it's not a blueprint, we were just planning ahead. Which, to anybody with half a brain, you would say, I'm not a child. I know that you guys are responsible because I'm reading your blueprint right here. This is from a website, Freedom Articles. I can post a link below. Captain Eric H. May, former U.S. Army military intelligence officer, stated the easiest way to carry out a false flag attack is by setting up a military exercise that simulates the very attack you want to carry out. And, oh, okay, like I just finished saying, they have it here. The purpose of the drill is to divert the attention and resources of police and other aspects of law enforcement away from the actual scene of the crime, as well as to cause confusion. Of course, confusion. It causes confusion. So you have all of these military personnel. Most of them think that a drill's going on. The real crap starts happening. They're confused. They kind of sit back and let it happen because it's like, oh yeah, there's a drill going on today, so this must be part of the exercise. And then when people legitimately start calling out for help from military agencies, then they kind of just say, oh yeah, there's a drill going on, don't worry, it's part of the routine. When in actual fact, something's happening. There's a whole laundry list of terrorist attacks that have occurred at the same time there have been military drills or intelligence agency drills going on at that precise time, or in a time frame very, very close by. So a week ahead of time, 2 weeks ahead of time, whatever, in close proximity. 9/11, as I just mentioned, the Oklahoma City bombing, the London July 7th bombings, all of these drills of the exact same scenario happening at the same time. The 2015 Paris attacks, the Boston Marathon. Many of the mass shootings have all been false flag attacks and have all had drills happening at the same time or in close proximity. The Sandy Hook shooting, the Charleston, South Carolina shooting, the movie theater shooting, the 2015 San Bernardino shootings, You had the 2019 New Zealand mosque shootings. All of these all had drills going on to either practice for what they were doing or to conceal and mask and cause confusion. Ladies and gentlemen, in March of 2020, the world officially announced a deadly pandemic that required lockdowns all over the world. This was also a formula that has been used and repeated for virtually every single campaign of fear in terms of health threats and health scares in the entire 21st century. And in 2020, it was again repeated, this time with meticulous planning. This manual is called the SPARS Pandemic, 2025 to 2028. It was cooked up by Johns Hopkins and various other health agencies in 2017, October of 2017, if I'm not mistaken. What this is a meticulous guide and blueprint that will help them navigate all of the anticipated events leading up to and during the time when a pandemic was to be announced. This is, it's a manifesto. Okay, it's a training manual. It serves as a guide from which the policymakers and policy planners and social engineers can use in order to navigate the intended release of fear propaganda. Now, it's about a 70-page document. InfoWars has a fantastic expose on the elements of this manual, some key elements in this manual. If you actually take the time to read through this, you would not believe, you would literally not believe what you're reading and how this was all written down in 2017 in perfect preparation for what happened in 2020. The events are to a T recorded in this manual as they unfolded in 2020 and beyond into 2021 and so on and so forth. And I know most people are not going to read this. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take it upon myself to narrate this manual to you so that it's easier for you to listen to. You can listen to it in the car while you're driving or doing whatever, and you can hear the meticulous planning that your government, your governmental agencies, and your ostensible authorities have. So that's the series that we're going to be starting up today. I hope you enjoy this. I hope this is worth your time. I would suggest that it is worth your time to listen to how this works, to listen to the narration, because you're going to be shocked. I'm also going to be adding some commentary here or there. I'll try to keep it to a minimum because I just want to dictate to you what's in the manual. So I'm going to try to minimize it. I'm going to tell you right now, it's going to be very difficult not to add your own input because this stuff just makes your blood boil, but I'll try to keep it to a minimum. Okay. Thank you very much, guys. I hope this is worthwhile again. And, let's get started reading you the SPARS Pandemic Training Manual for the actual release of a fear pandemic.
The SPARS Pandemic, 2025 to 2028. A futuristic scenario for public health risk communicators. Preface. Possible future in 2025, the echo chamber. Unbridled global access to information coupled with social fragmentation and self-affirming worldviews. Scenario purpose. The following narrative comprises a futuristic scenario that illustrates communication dilemmas concerning medical countermeasures, MCMs, that could plausibly emerge in the not-so-distant future. Its purpose is to prompt users, both individually and in discussion with others, to imagine the dynamic and oftentimes conflicted circumstances in which communication around emergency MCM develop, distribution, and uptake takes place. While engaged with a rigorous simulated health emergency, scenario readers have the opportunity to mentally rehearse responses while also weighing the implications of their actions. At the same time, readers have a chance to consider what potential measures implemented in today's environment might avert comparable communication dilemmas or classes of dilemmas in the future. Generation purpose. This prospective scenario was developed through a combination of inductive and deductive approaches delineated by Ogilvy and Schwartz. The time frame for this scenario, the years 2025 to 2028, was selected first, and then major socioeconomic, demographic, technological, and environmental trends likely to have emerged by that period were identified. Specifically, two dominant trends likely to influence regulatory and public responses to future public health emergencies were selected. 1. Varying degrees of access to information technology, and 2. Varying levels of fragmentation among populations along social, political, religious, ideological, and cultural lines. A scenario matrix was then constructed, illustrating 4 possible worlds shaped by these trends, with consideration given to both constant and unpredictable driving forces. Ultimately, a world comprised of isolated and highly fragmented communities with widespread access to information technology, dubbed the echo chamber, was selected as the future in which the prospective scenario would take place. From this point, scenario-specific storylines were then developed, drawing on subject matter expertise, historical accounts of past medical countermeasure crises, contemporary media reports, and scholarly literature in sociology, emergency preparedness, health education, and risk and communication. These sources were used to identify communication challenges likely to emerge in future public health emergencies. This prospective scenario is not intended to predict events to come, rather, it is meant to serve as a plausible narrative that illustrates a broad range of serious and frequently encountered challenges in the realm of risk and crisis communication. Readers aside, when this manual says it is not intended to predict events to come, understand that that is exactly what it is intended to do. That is just placed in the text so as to add a level of protection when inevitably this document reaches the public eye. So it's just a defensive stance that they can fall back on and say, oh, well, you know, this was never intended to predict. That's exactly what this manual is. It's a blueprint. It's a manifesto. Continuing. Scenario environment. In the year 2025, the world has become simultaneously more connected, yet more divided. Nearly universal access to wireless internet and new technology, including internet accessing technology, IAT. Thin, flexible screens that can be temporarily attached to briefcases, backpacks, or clothing, and used to stream content from the internet, has provided the means for readily sharing news and information. However, many have chosen to self-restrict the sources they turn to for information, often electing to interact only with those with whom they agree. This trend has increasingly isolated cliques from one another, making communication across and between these groups more and more difficult. From a government standpoint, the current administration is led by President Randall Archer, who took office in January 2025. Archer served as vice president under the President Jacqueline Bennett, 2020 to 2024, who did not seek a second term due to health concerns. The two remain close, and Bennett acts as a close confidant and unofficial advisor to President Archer. The majority of President Archer's senior staff, including Department of Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Sindra Nagel, are carryovers from Bennett's administration. At the time of the initial SPARS outbreak, Nagel has served in this position for just over 3 years. In regards to MCM communication, more specifically, the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, the Food and Drug Administration, and other public health agencies have increasingly adopted a diverse range of social media technologies, including long-existing platforms such as Facebook, Snapchat, and Twitter, as well as emerging platforms like ZapQ, a platform that enables users to aggregate and archive selected media content from other platforms and communicate with cloud-based social groups based on common interests and current events. Federal and state public health organizations have also developed agency-specific applications and ramped up efforts to maintain and update agency websites. Challenging their technological grip, however, are the diversity of new information and media platforms and the speed with which the social media community evolves. Moreover, while technologically savvy and capable, these agencies still lag in terms of their multilingual skills, cultural competence, and ability to be present on all forms of social media. Additionally, these agencies face considerable budget constraints, which further complicate their efforts to expand their presence across the aforementioned platforms, increase social media literacy among their communication workforces, and improve public uptake of key messages. Scenario organization and use. This scenario was designed to illustrate the public health risk communication challenges associated with distribution of emergency medical countermeasures during an infectious disease pandemic. The story is organized chronologically, and each chapter concludes with a treatment of key communication dilemmas and corresponding discussion questions. Some questions are targeted towards challenges faced by risk communicators representing federal agencies, while others address issues more relevant to state and local risk communicators. Readers aside, when they say communication dilemmas, what they mean is that the dilemmas they face in trying to have propaganda reach as many people as possible. So a risk, anytime in this text you hear communication dilemma or key communication dilemma, all it means is not a communication dilemma. It just means, how do we get our propaganda to reach as many people as possible? Continuing on. As such, users may find it most helpful to run the scenario as a tabletop exercise. Alternatively, if users prefer to examine select communication dilemmas rather than proceed chronologically through the entire scenario, they may refer to appendices A to D, which contain the timelines for the response and recovery phases of the story, as well as indices of the communication dilemmas and their corresponding page numbers. End of preface. Response. The SPARS outbreak begins. Chapter 1. In mid-October 2025, three deaths were reported among members of the First Baptist Church of St. Paul, Minnesota. Two of the church members had recently returned from a missionary trip to the Philippines, where they provided relief to victims of regional floods. The third was the mother of a church member who had also traveled to the Philippines with the church, but who had been only mildly sick himself. Based on the patient's reported symptoms, healthcare providers initially guessed that they had died from seasonal influenza, which health officials predicted would be particularly virulent and widespread that fall. However, laboratory tests were negative for influenza. Unable to identify the causative agent, officials at the Minnesota Department of Health's Public Health Laboratory sent the patient's clinical specimens to the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention, where scientists confirmed that the patients did not have influenza. One CDC scientist recalled reading a recent ProMed dispatch describing the emergence of a novel coronavirus in Southeast Asia and ran a pan-coronavirus RT-PCR test. A week later, the CDC team confirmed that the three patients were, in fact, infected with a novel coronavirus, which was dubbed the St. Paul Acute Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, bracket, SARS-CoV, or SARS. After the city where the first cluster of cases had been identified. Readers aside, this is supposed to be a fictional scenario. Notice how the fictional names for these fictional disease viruses or pathogen-causing viruses are identical to the real-world quote-unquote outbreak of SARS-CoV-2. Okay, and also, in addition, just recognize the RT-PCR test that they are proposing diagnosed infectious etiology. In this scenario, the RT-PCR test does not diagnose. It does not indicate that someone is infected or with a particular pathogen, and it also is incapable of determining that the virus is the cause of the symptoms. And the creator, the founder of the RT-PCR test, Kerry Mullis, was the most outspoken proponent, slamming the medical industry for using his test incorrectly. Kerry Mullis also inconveniently died very, very soon prior to the outbreak of the SARS-CoV-2 virus or the coronavirus 19. Okay, continuing on. The CDC monitored the situation closely, working with partners in Southeast Asia to quickly develop a case definition for SARS. Within 4 weeks of CDC publishing a working case definition on its website, nearly 200 suspected cases of SARS were reported across Minnesota and in six other states. Given that flu season was just getting underway and that a rapid diagnostic test for SARS-CoV infection was not yet available, CDC officials could not be sure if these were, in fact, true cases of SARS. Nevertheless, on November 17th, HHS Secretary Dr. Sindra Nagel notified the World Health Organization, WHO, about the U.S. cluster of SARS cases, concerned that the outbreak might constitute a public health emergency of international concern. As transmission of SARS was determined to occur via droplet spread, the CDC initially recommended that everyone diligently maintain hand hygiene and frequently disinfect potential contaminated surfaces. CDC officials further urged anyone with severe flu-like symptoms to seek immediate medical attention. Public health officials were concerned that the upcoming Thanksgiving holiday and Black Friday shopping activities would facilitate the spread of SARS, but they remained confident that the awareness and prevention messages disseminated annually for seasonal influenza, combined with isolation procedures for suspected cases, would be effective at countering the spread of SARS. These messages were spread via a variety of traditional and social media sources, including Facebook, Instagram, Reddit, Twitter, and ZapQ. Concern among many Americans about the severity of SARS at this point in the outbreak was moderately high. The public's concern was compounded by the apparent virulence of the pathogen. At the outset of the SARS outbreak, physicians' understanding of the disease stemmed primarily from extremely severe cases resulting in pneumonia or hypoxia that required hospitalization and extensive medical treatment. Mild cases of the disease, which produced symptoms including cough, fever, headaches, and malaise, were often perceived as the flu by the people who had them and consequently often went untreated and undiagnosed by medical personnel. As a result, early case fatality estimates were inflated. By late November, the CDC reported an initial estimated SPARS case fatality rate of 4.7%. By contrast, WHO reported that the overall case fatality rate for SARS was 14 to 15% and over 50% for people over the age of 64. Later, in the SPARS outbreak, data that included more accurate estimates of mild SPARS cases indicated a case fatality rate of only 0.6%. Two additional features of the SPARS virus that were not appreciated at the beginning of the pandemic, but that impacted how the outbreak played out, are also important to consider in a review of this event. First, the virus had an extended incubation period, 7 to 10 days, compared to its latent period, 4 to 5 days. Thus, infected persons could spread the virus for up to nearly a week before showing symptoms of the disease itself. As a result, isolating 6 SPARS patients proved to be less effective than isolating patients infected by other, better characterized respiratory diseases. Second, morbidity and mortality from SPARS were both significantly higher in children than adults. Pregnant women and those with chronic respiratory conditions like asthma and emphysema were also at higher risk for both disease complications and death. Side note, communication dilemma. Engendering public trust and a sense of self-efficacy when a crisis is still evolving and health information is incomplete. Food for thought. Number one, how can health authorities best meet public demands for critical information such as what is the health threat and what do I know about it when the crisis is still unfolding and not all the facts are known? Two, what benefits does monitoring trends in social media postings confer on efforts to meet people's information needs during an evolving health crisis? Number three, what medical and morale-boosting purpose does sharing information about self-protective actions, e.g. infection control measures, serve for public during an uncertain and fear-instilling situation? A Possible Cure, Chapter 2. The Center for Disease Control and Prevention, CDC, and state health departments are investigating the emergence of the St. Paul Acute Respiratory Syndrome coronavirus, SPARS-CoV, now reported in 26 states and several other countries. The purpose of this HAN advisory, readers aside, HAN meaning Health Alert Network, it's a fictitious news reporting agency that is listed here in the manual. Continuing on, the purpose of this HAN advisory is to update public health departments and healthcare facilities about this epidemic and to provide guidance to healthcare providers. At this time, the FDA and NIH are evaluating potential treatment options. Evidence indicates that antiviral pharmaceuticals may provide benefit. Based on previous trials in other coronavirus patients, the antiviral colosever is the leading candidate. However, neither the efficacy nor safety profile has been determined for SPARS cases. Further guidance regarding personal protective equipment and clinical care protocols are delineated below. Early in the SPARS pandemic, public health and medical professionals were hopeful that the outbreak could be contained through case identification and isolation. It quickly became clear, however, that this strategy was not as effective as initially hoped. First, challenges in identifying mild cases limited the impact of isolation programs. Because the initial symptoms of SPARS closely resembled influenza, many who contracted SPARS did not immediately seek care, assuming they merely had the flu. Fortunately, some who thought that they had the flu chose to isolate themselves at home, thereby preventing the spread of SPARS outside their households. Over the Thanksgiving holiday and Black Friday, however, fewer infected persons remained home, thereby enabling the spread of SPARS beyond the Midwest. Second, SPARS transmission was accelerated by infectious individuals who had not yet become symptomatic. Together, these factors led to a significant spike in the number of reported cases. By mid-December, SPARS cases were reported in 26 states, and the ministries of health in Mexico, Canada, Brazil, Japan, and several European countries had notified the WHO of dozens of imported cases. There was widespread concern in public health circles that travel over the Christmas and New Year's holidays would spark a global pandemic. The WHO, which had declared the SPARS pandemic to be a PHEIC on November 25th, was actively engaged in preventing further spread of the disease internationally. Readers aside, a PHEIC is a public health emergency of international concern. So, PHEIC, public health emergency of international concern. Okay, continuing on. However, the WHO's effort promoted interventions originally designed for influenza and other similar respiratory pathogens such as hygiene, social distancing, and isolation of suspected cases, all of which were less effective against SPARS. The CDC initially followed a similar strategy. The spike in cases in November and December, however, led to increasing public concern about the disease. By late December, public concern about SPARS in the United States was extremely high, and there was intense public pressure to identify treatments for the disease. At that time, no treatment or vaccine for SPARS was approved for use in humans. The antiviral Calocivir, which was initially developed as a therapeutic for severe acute respiratory syndrome, SARS, and Middle East respiratory syndrome, MERS, was one of several antiviral drugs authorized in the United States by the FDA to treat a handful of severe SPARS cases under its expanded access protocol. Calocivir had shown some evidence of efficacy against other coronaviruses, and a small inventory of the drug was already a part of the Strategic National Stockpile, SNS, in anticipation of FDA approval, despite some concerns about potential adverse side effects. The lack of concrete information regarding potential treatments in the face of the increasingly rapid spread of SPARS prompted demands from the media, the public, and political leaders for the FDA to be more forthcoming with information on potential treatment options. Side note, communication dilemma. Responding to the public and political pressure to share information about potential MCMs in the development pipeline, even though information may be incomplete or proprietary. Food for thought. 1. What risks do public health agencies face if the public, media, and/or political leaders feel that information about potential treatment options is being withheld? 2. What kinds of outreach could public health agencies perform in advance of a crisis to mitigate any perceived lack of transparency? If such a perception emerges in the crisis, then how might it be diffused? End of side notes and readers aside. So as this develops, you're going to see that this is nothing short of a formula, a blueprint that the social engineers can use so that they have a plan of action, a contingency for every possible scenario of resistance that they face when they decide to roll out this fear campaign of COVID-19. Okay, so as we continue reading, it will become very evident that this is not, you know, just insurance. This is a game plan. Chapter 3, A Potential Vaccine. Side text, a memorandum. To Greta Simpson, Vice President for Animal Health, from Dr. Marcus Thomas, Director, Vaccination Research Branch. Regarding Hooved Mammal Respiratory Virus Vaccine Number 14, HMRV-VAC-14, used in human populations. Oh, God. Date, December 30th, 2025. Attachments. 1. HMRV Vaccine 14 Efficacy and Side Effects. 2. Hoofed Mammal Respiratory Coronavirus Outbreak Model. Estimates, 2021. Problem Background. Your office requested information regarding any previous SPARS-like illness in GMI animal populations and potential immunization or treatment implications for the ongoing SPARS pandemic. Readers aside, GMI is simply the make-believe company that is issuing this memorandum. So the company involved. Continuing. Summary. In 2021, a coronavirus caused an outbreak in Region 7, Southeast Asia, of course. Hooved mammal populations. Our researchers developed and produced in-house an effective vaccine against the infection, HMRV-VAC-14. Its subsequent approval and use successfully ended the outbreak in the region. While largely effective in preventing infection, severe side effects, including swollen legs, severe joint pain, and encephalitis, potentially resulting in seizures, seizure disorders, or death, occasionally occurred. Given the millions of vaccinations required for Region 7, this resulted in measurable losses to the animal population. However, these were acceptable compared to those from the respiratory infection itself. Each of the severe side effects was accompanied by physical presentation such that the affected animal was removed from the population and culled to prevent processing affected animals for sale. It is unknown at this time how similar the two coronaviruses are, or whether HMRV-VAC-14 or a similar vaccine would be effective in human populations due to its development for internal use only. HMRV-VAC-14 has not been tested or authorized by any governing agency for use in animals or humans. Chapter 3. Shortly after authorizing expanded access to Colosiver for select patients, the FDA received reports of an animal vaccine developed by GMI, a multinational livestock conglomerate operating cattle and pig farms in, among other places, Southeast Asia since 2021. Ranchers had been using the vaccine to prevent a SPARS-like respiratory coronavirus disease in cows and pigs in the Philippines and other Southeast Asian countries. Data provided by GMI suggested that the vaccine was effective at preventing SPARS-like illnesses in cows, pigs, and other hooved mammals. But internal trials revealed several worrisome side effects, including swollen legs, severe joint pain, and encephalitis, leading to seizures or death. Because any animals experiencing these side effects were immediately killed, and because animals were typically slaughtered within a year of vaccination, further information regarding the short and long-term effects of the GMI vaccine were unavailable. Lacking a viable alternative, and considering the potentially high morbidity and mortality associated with SPARS, at the time the case fatality rate was still considered to be 4.7%, the United States government contacted GMI in regards to the vaccine. After laboratory tests confirmed that the coronavirus affecting livestock in Southeast Asia was closely related to the SPARS Cove, the U.S. began an extensive review of GMI's animal vaccine development and testing processes. Shortly thereafter, federal health authorities awarded a contract to SynBio, a U.S.-based pharmaceutical company, to develop a SPARS vaccine based on the GMI model. The contract included requirements for safety testing ensuring the vaccine would be safe and effective for human use. It also provided considerable funding from the National Institutes of Health and included provisions for priority review by the FDA. Additionally, HHS Secretary Nagel agreed in principle to invoke the Public Readiness and Emergency Preparedness Act, quote, PREP Act, or in brackets, PREP Act, thereby providing liability protection for SynBio and future vaccine providers in the event that vaccine recipients experienced any adverse effects. Side note, communication dilemma. Maintaining trust in government processes for ensuring the timely development of safe and effective vaccines when the novel threats arise. Oh my goodness. I'm sorry, readers aside, I'm sorry, I don't want to interrupt the flow of this text, but you have to imagine how deeply terrifying and frustrating it is to see how thoroughly planned and coordinated the attack on humanity was with the COVID-19 fake pandemic. And it's all right here. This is unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. Continuing on. Food for thought. 1. How might federal health authorities avoid people possibly seeing an expedited SPARS vaccine development and testing process as somehow rushed and inherently flawed, even though that process still meets the same safety and efficacy standards as other vaccines? 2. How might federal health authorities respond to critics who propose that liability protection for SPARS vaccine manufacturers jeopardizes individual freedom and well-being? 3. Once the vaccine becomes broadly available, see the chapter Head of the Line Privileges, how might public health communicators implement the best practices principle of enabling people to make their own informed decisions about whether to accept the novel SPARS vaccine? 4. What are the potential consequences of health officials over-reassuring the public about the potential risks of a novel SPARS vaccine when long-term effects are not yet known? Readers aside, they are preparing for what they know is going to be a vicious backlash by the informed aspect of public against rushed vaccines that have not been tested at all, that skipped animal trials, as is what happened in the real-life coronavirus fake pandemic. They are preparing for the inevitable resistance by the informed public, okay? And they're drafting up plans on how they're going to continue to pump out their propaganda and narrative so as to mitigate the damage caused by the resistance. This is unbelievable, ladies and gentlemen. We are going to end there for now, and we will continue and pick this up in part 2 of the reading of the SPARS Pandemic 2025 to 2028. The John Hopkins Center for Health Security. This was their fake, make-believe scenario that was conducted in 2017 to prepare for the real live release of a worldwide pandemic.